All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I was a CW-2 helicopter pilot in Vietnam, 1969. We want to welcome you to today's program, and it's going to be all about the Medal of Honor. But before I bring our guest on, I need to thank the people that make this program possible. Legal Help for Veterans, which is a disability law firm specializing in veterans' disability claims. For more information about Legal Help for Veterans, go to their website, and that's legalhelpforveterans.com. U.S. Wings, manufacturers of the finest all-natural leather flight jackets in the world. Go to uswings.com for more information. Just a reminder to all of you out there that each month, U.S. Wings has given away one of their fantastic leather flight jackets to one of our listeners. So go to our website, that's veteransradio.net, to enter in this month's drawings. We also want to thank all of our local veterans organizations for their continuing support. The local Charles S. Kettles, Vietnam Veterans of America, Post 310, Graft O'Hara, Veterans of Foreign Wars, Post 423, and the American Legion, Post 46, all from Ann Arbor, Michigan. All right, moving ahead. Our guest today is the founder of the Home for Heroes website, where you can find the most incredible library of information about America's war heroes. He's been on Veterans Radio many times over the last 15 years. Please welcome back Doug Sterner. Doug, welcome.
Good to be back with you again, Dale.
It is great, and I'm so happy to have you on the program and to talk about the Medal of Honor. It's such a fantastic and amazing award, and I think we just need to get right into it and tell people what is this Medal of Honor thing?
Well, the Medal of Honor was the United States of America's first award for combat heroism, established during the Civil War. And in the last century, through two world wars, Korea and Vietnam, become the symbol of ultimate sacrifice, ultimate courage, and, you know, ultimate bravery.
Right, to get the correct title, I'm looking at the website. As you said, you don't own it any longer, but you certainly did found it, and build it. and we can talk a little bit about that later on. But the correct title for the award is just Medal of Honor.
Yes, very simply the Medal of Honor. It's often called the Congressional Medal of Honor, but because it is authorized by the Congress, it's presented by the President in the name of the Congress, but the proper title of the award itself is simply the Medal of Honor. There are two things that people should bear in mind when discussing the award. One is the proper title, Medal of Honor. The other one is, and it's a common mistake that people make, is to refer to those who have received the Medal of Honor as Medal of Honor winners. And that's kind of like for the men who wear the Medal of Honor, like scraping your fingernails over a chalkboard. It just makes them shudder because they didn't win anything. In fact, in the actions for which they were awarded the Medal of Honor, many of them lost limbs, lost sight, lost some of their closest friends. So it's not an award that you win.
Right.
It's an award that you receive. So we refer to them as Medal of Honor recipients.
Okay. And when was the first Medal of Honor given out?
Well, the first Medals of Honor were actually awarded on 25 March 1863, which is why this particular interview is very, very timely. Mm-hmm. In the 1990s, in the state of Washington, they went back to the actual awards of the first Medals of Honor on March 25th, 1863, and proclaimed a National Medal of Honor Day for activities in the state of Washington. That began to be informally celebrated in other states when my wife and I began doing Medal of Honor activities in Pueblo. We began doing activities on National Medal of Honor Day, even though at that time it was not an actual date throughout the years. And then in 2004, when my wife introduced the Stolen Valor Act, we also introduced legislation nationally to establish a National Medal of Honor Day. That piece of legislation actually did not survive the Congress, but the following year, the Medal of Honor Foundation reintroduced that legislation and is now a national day of observance. National Medal of Honor Day is, in fact, National Medal of Honor Day by act of Congress.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good to know. It's an official day. They're right up in there with the rest of them. How many Medal of Honors have been given out? I mean, the legitimate ones, let's put it that way. We could talk more about that.
Legitimate ones. Well, and that's an interesting answer to that question. In fact, there have been 3,517 different acts of heroism that have resulted in the award of the Medal of Honor. However, in five cases in World War II, U.S. Marines serving with members of the U.S. Army got the Army Medal of Honor. And post-war, the Navy Department said, hey, these are our guys, and awarded them the Navy Medal of Honor. So they received both the Army and Navy Medal of Honor, which means that, in fact, actually a total of 3,522 Medals of Honor have been awarded in history for 3,517 different heroic acts.
Okay. And there's quite a few, or not quite a few, but there's a number of them that have received more than one.
Actually, a total of 19 individuals received two Medals of Honor. Five of those were the Marines that got both the Army and Navy Medal of Honor for the same action in World War II, or in World War I. But there are 14 others who received two Medals of Honor for two separate actions. One of the first, of course, being the younger brother of General George Armstrong Custer, Thomas Custer, who was the only person to get two Medals of Honor in the Civil War. And so there were a total of 19 double recipients of the Medal of Honor.
That's pretty amazing. That's kind of cool. All this information, folks, I want to keep reminding people, is on the website. It's called homeofheroes.com, and it's just a great place for anybody who's a military history junkie wants to know what these awards were for. The citations are all in there, and it's not just for the Medal of Honor. There's a number of other awards that you also talk about on there, but today we're kind of concentrating on the Medal of Honor. So who was the youngest person to ever receive the Medal of Honor?
There was drummers in the Civil War, I believe it was age 12 or 13. I can't remember right off the top of my head, drummer boy and the American Civil War. Of course, more recent conflicts, during World War II, a young fellow by the name of Jack Lucas, United States Marine, got the Medal of Honor for jumping on two grenades to save his buddies at Iwo Jima, and that was shortly after his 17th birthday, by which time he had been in the Marine Corps for 3 years already. Quite a character Jack Lucas was. And so, you know, in contemporary times, that would make him the youngest of all the persons to receive the Medal of Honor.
Right. Could you tell us a little bit more about Jack Lucas? He sounds pretty interesting.
Well, Jack Lucas was a character, and you know, I think that's the important thing. I think that's probably what we're going to talk about for the book of today is the personalities behind these individuals. Jack wanted to go kill Japanese and light his age, and enlisted in the Marine Corps, and he was in Hawaii at a time when they were preparing to ship his division to Iwo Jima, and the Marine Corps had learned that Lucas had light his age and was preparing to send him back home, and he traded backpacks with some long-lost cousin and stowed away on the ship bound for Iwo Jima, so he wasn't even supposed to be on Iwo Jima, but he was just determined to get into the war. He was a determined young man, and at Iwo Jima, when grenades were thrown in the midst of his comrades, he jumped on one and reached out with his arm and pulled the second one underneath him, the second one actually turned out to be a dud, so or he probably never would have survived, but he was gravely wounded by the other one that went off. Probably his life was saved, and he was saved from bleeding to death simply by the fact that the explosion blew that volcanic ash into his body, cauterizing the wounds and keeping him from bleeding to death. Hmm. And, you know, my family and I were privileged to know Jack during his lifetime, and, oh, he remained a character until the day we lost him.
Well, you've had the luck, I think, of being able to meet so many of these warriors and heroes, and I'm not using the term hero lightly here, that that's why I wanted you to come on and talk about some of these people that I was looking at on the site. Again, for our listeners, it's homeofheroes.com, and if you want to know anything about any of these people, pretty much all of it's there. We said that, you know, we just talked briefly about the youngest Medal of Honor recipient, and I found on your site it said it was Willie Johnson, who would earn the medal during the Civil War as a drummer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we've seen, for those of us that are kind of, you know, amateur history buffs, you know, we've seen paintings of some of these young boys, you know, either carrying the flag or being the drummers. And I think Matthew Brady also had some pictures of them. And it's just amazing. You're looking at these little kids. Well, everything is a little kid related to us these days, but just to see them in the midst of a battle.
It's amazing. And of course, that's the value that I think that these heroes serve. And I'm not afraid to use the term lightly. Mm-hmm. I'll throw it around with great fluency. These heroes are needed because our young men and women today need someone to look at and someone to admire and respect and realize that, you know, hey, I may be 16, 17 years old, but look at what Jack Lucas did, you know, and when push comes to shove, I can measure up and I can do what is required of me. Heroes inspire.
Absolutely.
And that's why we need heroes.
Right. Absolutely. And in fact, when we were talking before, there's a couple of people that I did want you to talk about because they were my heroes when I was growing up and probably a lot of people in our generation. One was Alvin York or Sergeant York. Can you tell me a little bit about him and how he received his medal and a little bit more about his character?
Well, Alvin York was a young soldier from Tennessee, backwoods, hillbilly, that was called to service in World War I. Alvin York had been kind of a hellion as a young man and got himself in a lot of trouble and had a very striking, and if you'll pardon the expression, but it's literally true, come to Jesus moment when he got religion.
Mm-hmm.
When he was struck by lightning. And if you watch the movie, it's pretty accurate in that.
Mm-hmm.
He became a conscientious objector. And this was prior to the beginning of the war. And then as the war began and he was called to service, he identified himself as a conscientious objector, did not want to kill anyone, wound up in France in a battle in which he saw his comrades being killed left and right, and he took it upon himself in that moment to use his marksmanship skills as a young man from Tennessee to systematically kill several Germans and ultimately capture 130.
I remember that in the movie. That was.
Well, and see, I'm glad you mentioned that movie because, you see, I think that is where the Medal of Honor changed in World War I.
Mm-hmm.
It's when we began to see these individuals as characters,
mm-hmm,
and hear their backstory. There had been, you know, nearly 2,000 Medals of Honor prior to World War I. Most of these were career soldiers. They were known in soldiers' communities, but the average citizen, the general public, didn't identify them as heroes unless they were, you know, some well-known individual that were well-known for some other role, such as Joshua Chamberlain, the He wrote Gettysburg, who mm-hmm. went on to become a famous politician. But generally, we didn't focus on war heroes. Even in the Spanish-American War, 1899, you had several Medal of Honor recipients. Most people of the time couldn't name anybody who received the Medal of Honor. They knew who Teddy Roosevelt was, who did not receive the Medal of Honor until decades later, because he was the former politician that mm-hmm. charged up San Juan Hill. Or they knew who Fighting Joe Wheeler was, who was not a Medal of Honor recipient because he was a former Civil War Confederate cavalry commander who now served in the United States Army. So the heroes were heroes because of position mm-hmm. and not because of what they did in a heroic moment or what they were as an individual. And out of World War II came the stories. Nobody heard of Alvin York until early in 1919, you know, 6 months after the war ended, when a small story was written about him in New York, and he suddenly became a popular individual, not just because he had captured 130 Germans. There had been other World War I heroes who had exploits that were, you know, on the same par with his.
Right.
That were not as well known, but because it was the backstory of the young man from Tennessee who didn't want to fight, didn't want to kill the conscientious objector, who came around and did what he had to do and then became the reluctant hero and just wanted to go home and work on getting better education for the people of his state. And so it was the backstory that really elevated him into that area of hero worship. And even then, he remained well below the radar until decades later when they made the movie Sergeant York, starring Gary Cooper, who got the Academy Award for portraying this World War I soldier on the advent of World War II when we needed a hero.
Right. So it's probably the advent of movies in general and the media. And I probably I didn't look it up. Did they give Lindbergh one, Charles Lindbergh, for his flight across the Atlantic? But that would be a civilian award. I know I'm mistaken here.
No, he was actually awarded the Medal of Honor. Charles Lindbergh okay. was an Army Reserve pilot.
Okay.
There are some who will argue against that award because it was a non-combat award. Mm-hmm. But at the time of his flight, he was awarded the highest honors by every other nation in the world. And the United States awarded him the Distinguished Flying Cross. And then as they looked at it, I said, well, geez, you know, every other nation has given him their version of the Medal of Honor. We've given him the Distinguished Flying Cross. And so basically it was politically motivated, but he was awarded the Medal of Honor then for that, mm-hmm. just as Admiral Richard Byrd was awarded the Medal of Honor in the same interim period for his exploration of poles.
Okay, right. Yeah. Well, we're talking with Doug Stern here, who's I think is probably the expert of all experts when it comes to knowing what is happening with Medal of Honor recipients and just medals in general for the American military. I said Doug Sterner. I left out a couple of letters there. We don't want to do that. you mentioned Sergeant York being a conscientious objector. There was another name that I came across that I thought was really just as interesting. That was Desmond Doss. Could you talk a little bit about him? Or I gave you that up. He was a conscientious objector as well.
Yes, he was. And I would say, you know, probably the greatest man I've ever met in my life.
Oh, you got to. You were very fortunate. You were very fortunate.
I'll tell you a vignette about him here when we get done with this. But Desmond Doss was just incredible. He was a young man who was Seventh-day Adventist. And during World War II, he was working a factory job that could have exempted him from service. However, he opted to go into the military service. He wanted to be a medical aid man.
Mm-hmm.
During his training, he refused to carry a gun or a knife He refused to train on Saturdays, being Seventh-day Adventist. And he prayed every night at his bedside to the taunts and tossed boots of his comrades. And he really went through the kind of bullying that I could just not even begin to imagine. The man had an incredible inner strength. He was tall and he was skinny and lanky, but he was a brute inside to be able to stand up to that kind of thing.
Sure.
Attempts were made to kick him out of the service under a Section 8 discharge mentally, because he was a mental case. And he fought that because he said, I'm not against war, I'm against killing. And he was able to somehow in his own mind separate the two. His sergeant wanted him out of the military in the worst way, but was unsuccessful in doing it. Now, back in World War II, they trained as a unit and they deployed as a unit. So the very same people that he had trained with, that threw boots at him while he prayed, that tried to get him kicked out, deployed with him to the Pacific Theater. His first action was during the invasion of Leyte. And there was a man, a young soldier, laying out in the middle of a field wounded by a sniper, and nobody could get to him. And Desmond Doss went out under fire into that field to try and reach and treat that wounded man. And his friends kept saying, no, there's a sniper out there. We don't know where he is. They'll get you. And Desmond went out anyway. And for that action, he was awarded the Bronze Star. And it's when they began to rethink Desmond Doss. From there, the battle went on to Okinawa. And the battle raging across Okinawa came to a virtual wall. That wall is known as the Maeda Escarpment. It's a near vertical cliff that leads to a plateau above. The Japanese owned the upper part of the plateau, and the American allies were down at the base. And American forces were preparing to assault the wall. Interesting story. The movie was great. The movie just had a few things out of order. But, you know, one of their earliest assaults, as they were preparing to assault the hill, Desmond Doss said to his commander, he said, don't you think we should pray before we assault? And the commander said, okay. And he gathered the men around and he said, okay, guys, Doss wants to pray for us. And Doss said, he was so embarrassed. He said, this was not what I had in mind. I just thought everybody should pray to themselves. So Desmond Doss prayed, and they assaulted the Maeda Escarpment, and companies on either side of them sustained multiple casualties trying to scale the Maeda Escarpment. Desmond Doss's company didn't have a single wounded among them.
Wow.
The assault was unsuccessful, but the irony of it was, when they sent the report back to intelligence, they asked, you know, why did not your company have any casualties? And the official response was, quote, Doss prayed, unquote.
I just found that story was just amazing. And again, this is another story that is on the website, homeofheroes.com. So I'm strongly encouraging everybody to go to this site. You just won't believe what some of these what happened to these men, especially probably in the next 20 years, we're going to be adding women to the list as well. I think that's something that's probably going to be occurring in today's world. We've got about 5 minutes here before we have to take a break. Let's talk a little bit about the only group that, let's see, the only father and son that won, that received the Medal of Honor, and that was the MacArthurs.
Well, that was up until a few years ago.
Okay.
During the Civil War, Arthur MacArthur, the boy colonel, received the Medal of Honor for carrying his flag up Missionary Ridge. Ironically, 50 years later, at the reunion of his regiment, he was the speaker for the survivors of that regiment. He got up to speak and he said, "Your indelible regiment." And he paused, and he gasped, and he collapsed to the floor.
Oh, no.
And his comrades gathered around him, and the man who had been their surgeon looked up, and he said, "Gentlemen, the colonel is dying." and they recited the Lord's Prayer around him. And when they had finished, Arthur MacArthur passed away. The minutes of the meeting state, whereupon the adjutant went to the wall and took from it the flag that he had so valiantly carried up Missionary Ridge and gently wrapped the body of the general in that flag.
Oh, goodness.
So he was carried out of that reunion 50 years later, wrapped in the same flag that he had got the Medal of Honor in the Civil War for carrying up Missionary Ridge.
That is, that's quite the story.
Yes. Of course, his oldest son received the Navy Cross, the Navy's highest award, posthumously in World War I. And his other son, Douglas MacArthur, went on to receive the Distinguished Service Cross and several Silver Stars in World War I, and then to command American forces in the Pacific in World War II, like his father, ultimately receiving the Medal of Honor. And so they were, for decades, the only father and son to receive the Medal of Honor. Then about 15 years ago, to make a correction, the military services went back and properly awarded the Medal of Honor to Theodore Roosevelt.
Right.
For that famous charge up San Juan Hill, making him and his son, Theodore Roosevelt Jr., who received the Medal of Honor for his heroism at, in World War II. He was the only general officer to land on the beaches of Normandy on D-Day. He and his son, Quentin, were the only father and son to land on the beaches of Normandy on D-Day. And he subsequently died on the beach a week later from a fibrillating heart.
That's awesome.
Making the Roosevelts also father and son recipients of the Medal of Honor.
Wow. It, again, we're talking with Doug Sterner here, is kind of the founder of the website, the Home of Heroes, and we want to we're going to take a break here in just a moment, and when we come back, we're going to talk about some other amazing stories of these Medal of Honor recipients throughout the years. And actually, we're going to start off probably with Audie Murphy, who we think again was one of those heroes that we heard about when we were all children through the movies. And that did that. So we're going to take a break right now, and we will be back shortly. You're listening to Veterans Radio, and we will be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Commander Eugene Fluke, with four Navy Crosses and the Medal of Honor, is one of the most highly decorated servicemen in American history. Details after this. Fluke submarine moving along the China coast located a convoy of more than 30 Japanese ships anchored in a harbor. The harbor was shallow and heavily mined with threatening rock formations. If he got close enough to attack, it would require a run at full speed under very dangerous conditions. Fluke ordered the attack anyway. In water only 30 feet deep, he maneuvered to within range and launched four torpedoes from the forward tubes and four from the rear tubes. He watched eight direct hits, turned his sub around, and headed for open sea. He was awarded the Medal of Honor by Navy Secretary James Forrestal on March 23, 1945. 4 months later, Fluke, after sinking an enemy frigate, landed a shore party on the Japanese coast, which set an explosive device on railroad track that destroyed a military train. This was the only combat operation on the Japanese mainland during the war. Fluke retired in 1972 as a rear admiral. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
And we're back here on Veterans Radio, and as you can tell, we're going to be talking about Medal of Honor recipients, and I thought that one was a really great story. Our guest today is Doug Sterner, and Doug is the founder of the Home of Heroes website. He passed that along to people that we work with, Legal Help for Veterans, and so it's still up and it's running, and it's a great site for all of you military historians out there, and I think it's a great opportunity for you to find out more and more information. And I should go back to the Medal of Honor that we just played with, as you called it, Lucky. Let's talk a little bit about Lucky.
Well, Lucky Flucky, and that's how I always remembered how to pronounce his name. The Medal of Honor and four Navy Crosses, unprecedented, unequaled by any other person in history. And, of course, his Medal of Honor action in the bay and the sinking of the ships is legendary. He also pioneered some very, very unique missile and radar tests on his ship, the USS Barb, but best known for that moment in time when he was cruising along the coast of Japan in July of 1945, and he saw that train coming down the railroad tracks along the coast, and his through the periscope, and his people said, "Hey, let's go blow that up." And so they decided, okay, Spocky said, who wants to volunteer? And everybody aboard the Barb, of course, volunteered to go by rubber boat into the shore, take one of the submarine scuttling charges, and use it to blow up the train track. And Gene Plucky, who was an Eagle Scout, said, "Well, I will insist that half of the eight volunteers be former scouts. How many of you are former scouts?" And he actually picked four men who were former Boy Scouts, knowing that they would at least understand how to improvise and survive if anything went wrong. They went ashore and they blew up a train, and he got them safely back to his ship. And on the battle flag of the USS Barb was a locomotive, the only train to sink a ship, and that was the only combat action, ground combat action, on Japanese soil of World War II. So Lucky Flucky became a legend. He subsequently wrote a book titled Thunder Below, and every convention he ever went to, he would be sitting out there selling copies of his book. If you bought a copy of his book, he autographed half a page to you. He was just very, very kind to everybody. And all the proceeds from the sales of those books, decades later, went to funding reunions of the men who had served on the USS Barb during the war.
Oh, what a great story. What a great story. I'm looking again on the website. They're the Home of Heroes, and Lucky Flucky is on there, and there's a line here that says the U.S. Barb was indeed the submarine that sank a train. I love that. I love that. I'm assuming his book is probably still available somewhere.
Yeah, I'm sure it's available out there in any number of places. So, you know, I don't know if you can find it on Amazon or not, but there are other places that you can buy used books often.
Yeah.
So I'm sure it's available out there.
And in our little version of it, they mentioned being in 30 feet of water, I think is what he said. But when I was reading the story here, he was only 6 feet off the bottom of the bay that they were in.
I mean,
that took a lot of skill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was a very, very skillful guy. The only thing was he couldn't remember my name.
Oh.
My wife, I had called him one time, this was several years ago, and Margaret Plucky, his wife, answered the phone, and I said, Doug Turner here, I said, "Is the Admiral around?" And I heard her yell, "Gene, it's Doug Sterner." And I heard him say, "Who?" And she said, "It's Doug Sterner." And he said, "Who?" And she said, "Pam Sterner's husband." Put him on.
Oh. Well, we know.
So he didn't remember me, but he always remembered my good-looking blonde wife.
There you go. We always knew who has the power in the family, right? That's what it always is. Well, this is another great story, the Lucky Flucky's story. Let's go now back to Audie Murphy. And again, this was one of those heroes that I had heard about when I was growing up and, you know, playing out in the woods behind my house. Somebody was always Audie Murphy, and somebody was another hero and so forth. And then he ended up being in the movie. So what can you tell us about him? And of course, I know that there is somebody who ended up with more awards than he did.
Well, not necessarily, and we can discuss that, but just to talk about Audie Murphy himself, of course. Audie Murphy was that young kid from Texas who should never have been, by standards that we think of an American hero. I mean, he was just a little tiny guy, 110 pounds, 5 feet, 5 inches tall. His father had abandoned the family when he was young. His mother died when he was 16. A couple of his siblings were put into foster homes. He had completed the fifth grade by the time he was 15 years old and then quit school. And so when World War II came, he said, you know, well, I'm going to go join the military, and at least I can help support the rest of my siblings that are living in this boxcar on the outskirts of town.
Wow.
And so all 110 pounds of him walked into the Army Airborne and recruiter, and the Army Airborne recruiters looked at him and laughed and said, no way, kid. And so he went down to see the Navy recruiter, and they wouldn't have anything to do with him, and the Marine Corps recruiters just laughed him out. They said, maybe go home and eat some bananas, you know, that'll beef you up a little bit. So he went home, and he did. He ate bananas to beef up his weight, finally got it up enough to go back to the Army, and the Army said, well, they would hire him as a cook. So he went in, and but he was determined not to be a cook. He wound up becoming an infantryman, went to Italy with the 3rd Infantry Division, and in August 1944, he was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross, the Army's highest award, and 6 weeks later, in a span of 2 days, he earned 2 more Silver Stars, and 3 months later, he received the or earned the Medal of Honor in the famous Action on the Tank, where in the movie you hear someone ask him on the radio how close are the Germans, and his response, taken from real life, was, "Hang on to the phone, I'll let you talk to one."
You know, that's that. That's just so typical, it seems, from so many of the, you know, you have met many more Medal of Honor recipients than I have, but the ones I have met are just so humble and down to earth. And you mentioned, you know, if Audie Murphy was, you know, 110 pounds, our local Medal of Honor recipient who just passed away, Charlie Kettles, couldn't have been much more than that. And was just a genuine gentleman. And you look at him and you go, how did he do what he did? And I think they're great stories. And this is one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on the program, to give us a background on some of these people. So we've got Audie Murphy out there, but there was also somebody going on around the same time. His name was Footsie Britt, Maurice Footsie Britt. Tell me a little bit about Footsie Britt.
Well, you know, Footsie was quite an interesting character. He played football, All-American Arkansas Razorback. Played one season with the Detroit Lions before the war, and then he went to Europe with Audie Murphy's same unit, the 3rd Infantry Division, and actually he became the first person to receive all of the Army's top valor awards, Medal of Honor, Distinguished Service Cross, Silver Star, and Bronze Star in a single action, and all of them before Audie Murphy even hit the scene. So he set the stage for Audie Murphy. Unfortunately, Footsie Britt was severely wounded in the last action, for which he received the DSC, and lost his arm, which meant he could not go back to a football career, but he did come back home. His Medal of Honor was actually presented on the same football field where he had played for the Arkansas Razorbacks, and he went on to become Lieutenant Governor of Arkansas. Just incredible, incredible, incredible man. And I got to throw this in for you, okay?
Go ahead.
Okay. We were bringing Footsie Britt out here to Pueblo, Colorado for an event in 1995. And we were communicating back and forth. And just my wife and I were getting ready. It was the spring of 95. We were getting ready to go out to Washington, D.C. for a thing that we had to go out there for. And we got a phone call just before we left from Footsie Britt saying, I'm sorry, I'm not going to make it for the 4th of July in Pueblo. He said, I'm back in the hospital. Pam and I flew out to Washington, D.C., and one of the things that we were doing while we were there was meeting with a particular senator who is my personal hero by the name of Bob Dole.
Okay.
And we were visiting with Bob Dole, and we subject turned to the Medal of Honor, and And Bob says, oh, he said, yeah, I was just thinking about one of my friends the other day, Footsie Britt from Arkansas. And I said, oh, I just got a phone call from Footsie here just before we left. You know, he's back in the hospital. And he said, what hospital? I said, well, I didn't know. So Pam and I came back home. And when I called, found out what hospital Footsie was in. And I called that back to Senator Dole's office. We were trying to actually get Senator Dole to come out for our event. And he contacted us that he couldn't do that because he had just announced that he was going to run for president.
Oh.
Well, Footsie got better. And he came to Pueblo for our 4th of July activities. And while he was here, he kept saying to me again and again, oh, Doug, thank you so much for telling Senator Dole about me. That meant so much. That meant so much. And I figured that Senator Dole must have called him, sent him a card, done something. Footsie was just so happy. Well, Footsie died late that winter. Mm-hmm. And I was going through all the news reports, and there out of Arkansas was a story about last spring, Footsie was in the hospital, not doing well. Senator Bob Dole had just announced that he was running for president, and he was flying to Florida when he diverted his private plane to Little Rock, Arkansas, and took a taxi cab to the hospital to visit Footsie Britt in the hospital.
Boy, there's a lot of respect right there.
Wow.
Absolutely. Yeah, Christmas. That's cool. That's a great story. That's a great story. And your website is just full of all of these things here, of these stories. And I want to get to another one here real quick. And that's Bill Crawford. Bill Crawford was a janitor.
Yeah, Bill Crawford was a young man from our hometown of Pueblo, Colorado. He was one of the first people that got us involved in the Medal of Honor activities. Young boxer before he went into the service in World War II. He was captured at Alta Vela, Italy, taken to a POW camp. His Medal of Honor was actually presented posthumously to his father at Camp Carson, which is now Fort Carson, because they thought Bill Crawford had been killed and he was missing in action. They subsequently, Red Cross finally identified him as being alive in a prisoner of war camp and notified him that he had been awarded the Medal of Honor. And he often spoke about how he was treated as a celebrity by his German captors who respected him for that Medal of Honor. He came back home. His Medal of Honor was never actually presented to him. It had been presented to his father. He served as a recruiter in the Army, finished his career, and then settled down up in Palmer Lake, which is just north of Colorado Springs, and went to work as a janitor at the U.S. Air Force Academy.
Okay.
One of the students in the 1980s was reading a book about heroes and ran across a story about Bill Crawford in World War II, and the next day he approached him. He said, you know, is this you? And Bill Crawford said, well, yeah, that's a long time ago. He's a very self-effacing man. Mm-hmm. And that particular cadet went back to his fellow cadets. He said, you know what? Our janitor is a Medal of Honor recipient. And the cadets, when they learned that he had never received his Medal of Honor, had it presented to himself, actually began the workings that resulted in President Ronald Reagan, while coming to speak at the commencement services at the U.S. Air Force Academy, brought old Bill Crawford up there in his old World War II uniform and presented the Medal of Honor to him. Quite an incredible guy Bill Crawford was.
It's a great story. Again, we're talking with Doug Sterner here. His website it's the Home of Heroes, and I encourage all of you to go to this Home of Heroes website. I think you'll really enjoy it. There are so many different stories on there, not just Medal of Honor recipients, but others as well. And in fact, there was one story that really caught my eye, and I wanted to talk to you just briefly about that. And this was a pilot named Bill Rising, and I probably got him backwards, and a navigator John Montgomery. Can you tell us a little bit about their adventure? That's an adventure to me.
You told me we weren't going to go there, so I didn't refresh my
Well, that's all right. I can do it. These guys were my computer shut down here, but the main part of the story is that they were in the South Pacific, and their plane was caught on fire. I mean, it had been hit by ground fire and so forth, and so they were going to bail out, and they had trouble bailing out. They both of them got out on the wings ready to jump off, and the engine seemed to kind of re-catch, and they ended up landing it, ended up being out in the islands for weeks, if I remember correctly. And it's just a fascinating story to me, and I know that they were supposed to be picked up, and the rendezvous PT boats never showed for over a week or so, and they were just kind of living off the land. It's kind of like, you know, as you mentioned earlier, they wanted to be Boy Scouts so that they could survive. And it ends up kind of being a sad story, because one of them, Bill Rising's wife, drove all the way across the country when they heard that he had survived, because she'd gotten the telegraph or a telegram that they did in those days, you know, that said he'd been lost at sea and was missing in action. And they drove all the way across the country to get him. And as they were driving home, unfortunately, they were in a car accident, and both he and his wife were killed. But it just shows you the grit of some of these men at that time, you know. And it's a wonder why we talk about the greatest generation, and I realize that that today's military, men and women are just as brave and just as strong, and but wow, you know, these guys, you know, the thing that they always brought to my attention was the amazing amount of American ingenuity. And you can probably think of some other characters that you have met that as a result.
Oh, yes.
Go ahead.
It goes on and on. And, you know, I get a kick out of the people that are now rebuilding and modernizing the Home of Heroes website. I'm so thankful for the work that they're doing, because they're taking it to the next level. But, you know, they told me, the guy who runs it now says, you know, any given week, I have like three people working on it, and they say, one guy did all this? And I look back and I said, you know, trust me, you know, when I look back on all those stories, and that's why I can't necessarily pull them off the top of my head right off the bat, yeah, like I could with Bill Rising and Montgomery, I look back and I say, how in the world did I do it? But these are important, and, you know, we focused on the Medal of Honor because this is a week of National Medal of Honor Day. Mm-hmm. But there are these other heroes. The Medal of Honor is not the only award, and often the only difference between a Navy Cross or Distinguished Service Cross and a Medal of Honor was how good the clerk was that typed up the citation.
Right. You know, I mean, absolutely.
One of my favorite stories from the South Pacific is a guy who was shot down, and he and his comrades were under siege, and he was attacked, and he was weaponless, and he killed a Japanese with a coconut. You know, there are some incredible stories that are in there, and they're important not just because they're incredible stories, but here's what makes Medal of Honor recipients in particular and military heroes in general so important to our society, is because among the ranks, everyone can find someone to identify with. Mm-hmm. The little skinny kid can look at Audie Murphy or
Chuck Kettles, you know.
Yeah, or Baker, who in his Medal of Honor, you know, old 5'2" Baker and his commander, Foley, who was 6'5" or 6'6", the tallest and shortest in the same action. They can look at him and identify. The little kid that comes from a broken home can look at the recipient that comes from a broken home say, This young man rose above it, and look at what he did. Or, you know, the kid that gets in trouble can look at, you know, the young gangbanger from Philadelphia in World War II that went to training and chickened out and ran home, and the cops picked him up and said, well, you can go to jail or you can go back to your unit. And he went back to his unit, went to Europe, and became the great Commando Kelly.
Oh.
That shows us you can have a second chance.
Yeah, there's a lot of examples like that. That I've run across as well. I just had Alan Lynch on from the Vietnam War on last week, and you know, his whole childhood was just, he was bullied his entire life almost, it seemed like, And he joined the military because he had to prove something to himself. And he says, and they still beat me up in basic and they beat me everywhere. And the next thing you know, he's out in the field and somebody gets wounded, you know, 70 yards away in a ditch, and he runs across the open field and, and you know, and gets them. And all these people that are just, you know, they're just everyday Americans. They're just everyday soldiers. So many of them. I mean, there's a vast number of Medal of Honor recipients that, you know, were Latino or Japanese, you know, heritage or anything like that. It's just across the board, which I think is really what's so interesting to me about that. I think it's so
exactly.
Cool.
No matter who you are, among the, you know, 3,400 Medal of Honor recipients that we have the records for, you're going to find someone that you can identify with.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever your circumstances, your backstory, your whatever you're dealing with, you can read the story about one of these guys who rose above that and did what needed to be done, and they can become your inspiration. And so that's why these stories are so critically important.
Well, I think and it's so important that you were able to save these stories or to record these stories. And it's something that we're doing here on Veterans Radio, is we're trying to gather up as many stories as we possibly can before everybody's gone. And
exactly, because the history records the citations.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can't really say that because they've lost so many citations. And we discussed this the last time we were on. The citation says, on this date, in this moment, so-and-so did such and such, and it's like reading a medical journal. It's all, you know, facts, and yet behind them, there are so many interesting stories. You could read about what Audie Murphy did and envision him as the Incredible Hulk, 6'5",
right,
carrying a Browning automatic rifle and just, you know, cigar. You can't picture him as, you know, 110-120 pound kid.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why having that backstory is so important, because it helps put us into the reality of who these heroes really are.
I couldn't agree with you more, Doug. It's a great service that you have done in originally building this site, and I know that you worked on it probably almost your entire life, it sounds like, to get all this information in one place, and that, you know, you made a lot of sacrifices, and as did your beautiful wife, to allow you to do these things. And I think that, you know, we are all very, very appreciative of all the effort, of course, that went into it. And I want to make sure people go to homeofheroes.com and just enjoy it. I mean, it's such a pleasure to and the way that it's set up now, it's so easy to move around the site and find pictures and find stories and everything else that's out there. You wanted me to remind you with about 5 minutes to go to bring you back to our friend Desmond Doss. So I'm doing that right now. We got about 5 minutes to go.
Okay, yeah, we didn't talk about his Medal of Honor action. We did talk about, you know, the incident where Doss prayed.
Right.
Doss later, his unit later assaulted the Maida escarpment. And when they got to the top of the escarpment, fierce battle ensued. And the American forces were pushed back down this, you know, 100-foot cliff to their base camp. The only people left at the top of the escarpment were the Japanese and the wounded. And Desmond Doss, earlier in his life, had invented this knot with a rope. And he took this and invented this knot, and he took that knot and used it to create a sling. And one by one, under fire, began lowering wounded from the top of the escarpment down to their comrades below. Oftentimes, the Japanese approached him to be shot by another wounded person. I mean, he was under fire the entire time. And he stood there letting down soldier after soldier after soldier. And when he had finished and come down to the bottom of the escarpment himself, his commanding officer said, you know, I'm going to put you up for the Medal of Honor. He said, you saved 100 lives today. And Desmond says, nah, not humanly possible. maybe 50, which is why when they wrote his Medal of Honor citation, they split the difference and credited him with saving 75 of his comrades.
Let me come back to this story. He lowered them down. And how high was this escarpment here?
It's about 100 feet. Cliff.
That took a long time.
Yes. And he's in the absolute open. And just think about that. Think about a soldier, 150 pounds, 200 pounds, the end of a rope, and skinny old Desmond up there with rope around a stump, just lowering him down one after another. His sergeant said, you know, the bravest man I ever met was the man I tried to get kicked out of the Army. A few weeks later, they did go back up on the escarpment, and fierce battles ensued. Desmond himself was severely wounded. Stretcher bearers came by to pick him up, and they were carrying him out when they ran across another wounded guy, and Desmond rolled off the stretcher and said, take him, and bound up one of his fractures with a rifle butt. When he finally began to become cognizant off the coast of Iwo Jima on a hospital ship, he reached up to pat his pocket, and he said, get the word back to my men. I've lost my Bible. It was a New Testament that had been a wedding gift to him from his wife. And these guys who had once thrown boots at him while he prayed, who wanted him kicked out of the military, when the word came back to the unit that Desmond Doss had lost his Bible, they stormed that escarpment, lined up abreast, and walked the escarpment until they found his Bible and mailed it home to him back in the United States.
Wow. What a great story. What a just a terrific story about, an ordinary man who just did extraordinary things.
And Desmond, throughout his life, you know, back in Georgia, one time there were some scouts that were lost in a cave. Desmond was dealing with health issues. Desmond went out, worked all night in that cave to help find them. Mm-hmm. I could hardly wait to meet Desmond. He was my hero. And so my wife and I were invited to the Medal of Honor reunion in 1993 in Charleston, and I could hardly wait to meet Desmond, and I saw him walk into the room, and he just looked so sad. And somebody said he just lost his wife. His wife was killed in a car wreck last year. And so I didn't really get the chance to meet him. In 1995, 3 years later, Pam and I were bringing a bunch of Medal of Honor recipients to Pueblo for National Medal of Honor Day, March 25th, 1995. And they were going to be doing school assemblies in every single school, 53 schools in our city and county in a single day. I needed, in order to do that, a total of 17 Medal of Honor recipients. And 1 week before the event, I got a phone call one night from Lala Benavides, and she said, Doug, Roy just went into the hospital. Roy Benavides was one of my favorite people, Medal of Honor recipient. And he's not doing well. We're not going to be able to make it to the event in Pueblo. And I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, I've got to have 17 Medal of Honor recipients to cover all these schools. So I'm calling the Medal of Honor Society, and Mike Williams, the son of a Medal of Honor recipient, director at that time, and we're going over names and going after over names, and for 2 days, excuse me there, for 2 days, I'm trying to get somebody. No luck. And finally, one night, I'm talking to Mike, and Mike says, well, Doug, have you thought about Desmond Doss? And I said, oh, no, I hadn't even given that a second thought. Last time I saw Desmond, he was not looking good. He said, oh, Desmond has remarried. And he's doing very well. Now, this is like 4 days before our event in Pueblo. I called Desmond. I said, sir, you've never met me. We've got a thing coming up in Pueblo. I need a Medal of Honor recipient to speak in 3 schools 4 days from now. He said, can I bring my wife? Just like that. I said, absolutely. He came to Pueblo. He brought a hunk of rope with him and got up in the school assemblies and would bring a child up and tie his knot and put it on the child to show him how he let the people down the Maida escarpment. That's the kind of man that Desmond Doss was. Not just a hero in World War II, but a hero every day of his life.
That's a great story. I think one of the things that I've found in talking to the Medal of Honor people I've talked to is that they have such a response. They feel like they have such a responsibility to, you know, live a life that that their comrades couldn't live because they're gone. And mm-hmm. and so they, you know, they go way up above and beyond, and, you know, living up to, you know, what the medal means to the people that are still in the service, and not, you know, not just to civilians, but how important it is to the people that are in the service. And I think that that's certainly is admirable of somebody, you know, like Desmond Doss, but like I said, all the ones I have met have been just like that. They go out of their way to help. They'll show up, and, you know, if you call them up and say, hey, I need to have somebody here right away, you know, okay, I'll be there, not a problem. And I think that's just terrific. We've been talking with Doug Sterner all program, all about the Medal of Honor and some of the interesting things that go on with that. And Doug, I want to thank you so very much for being on our program. It's always an honor to talk to you and to have you on here. And I encourage our audience again to go to the website, homeofheroes.com. And all these stories are there, and, of course, our program will be up on the web in a couple of days, and you can listen to this whole interview again if you'd like to. So, Doug, thank you, and I'm going to get you back on and talk about that book publishing idea you have.
We'll do that, Dale. Yeah, very, very good. Anytime you need me, just holler.
I will do that. Thank you very much, and for our audience, until next time, you are dismissed.